Today is June 12th, is that right? It's the 12th? Yeah, that's Saturday, June 12th, Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery, 2021. 25 years of Abhayagiri honoring our elders retreat. So I've been thinking a lot about elders and different ajahns, different great ajahns that we're connected with, both the Thai and the Western ajahns. And largely that's what causes this monastery to exist and caused it to come about. So it all comes from the Dhamma of the Lord Buddha. So the Buddha being the ultimate ajahn, being the primary ajahn, and then down through history to the Thai forest ajahns, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, and down on to our own teachers, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, and so on. So that's what makes this monastery come about. And so for myself, I got here in year 5 of the monastery. So 2001, it was still pretty basic at that time. I think about where Ajahn Kasapa was sitting, there was a power pole there, a leaning power pole that had the electricity going to the main house. It was somewhere around there. And couldn't imagine there'd be a big building here. And although it was planned, this building was planned, but it changed forms many times over the years. And so there's a lot of good stories from the very beginning of the monastery, but then there's the whole middle period of the whole, just like the long slog of building and running a monastery over the years. So it's like there's a marriage. Everybody looks at the pictures of the marriage and remembers the marriage, but then after that, maybe there's not that many pictures for the next 20 years. And so we remember the beginnings, but then the middle is kind of difficult to remember. Endings are easy to remember. Beginnings and endings are easy to remember. So the whole, just the grind of the daily life and what was brought from Thailand, and just the daily schedule, following the daily schedule here, and how the daily schedule itself actually changed and was, people were trying to figure out how to best do it here. Of course, Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro bringing the hardcore Thai forest practice from Thailand, and the Wanpra staying up on the lunar observance days. And so originally, and Ajahn Kurudamo can interrupt me if I get anything wrong here, there was a work period on the day after Wanpra originally, is that right? And the Wanpra was stay up till dawn. It wasn't end at 3:30. It was everybody stays up till dawn, and then there's a work period. So once the monastery truck was driven off the hillside on a day after Wanpra work period, then they decided, oh, maybe, because he fell asleep at the wheel, and maybe we have to assess the situation here and try to do something a bit more sustainable. Nobody was hurt, but I believe the truck just got kind of went off the hillside and got hung up in some manzanitas. Oh, it tipped over. Okay. So that was a few years before I got here, but it was definitely a story that was being told, still being told when I got here. And then the next one was, okay, so no work period on the day after Wanpra. They'll take a day off. And then, but then, because a lot of the monks here like to work, so they would still work. And then it became, okay, well, if you really want to do something, no power tools. No power tools on the day after the observance day. So that became a danger. And then it was something similar at Nanachat happened. It used to be that robe washing day, everybody would come together at the dyeing shed, the robe dyeing shed, for robe washing day and dye making. Robe washing day used to be on the day after the observance day, so after the all-night sit. There were so many conflicts that they changed it to the day before the observance day to mitigate some of the conflicts that were happening. And everybody's really tired and wanting to get their robes washed. Yeah. So then it went to the chanting at 3 a.m., the morning chant, and then everybody could go for a rest if they wanted to at 3:30. So that's the form it was in when I was here, but when I first came. But I know even though that was allowable, Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro were still towing the line in terms of staying up till dawn. And so I remember my first Wanpra and just coming here as a lay guest and wanting to really do the practice and wanted to be very serious about practice. But then this Wanpra thing is like, oh, by 11 p.m. it's just so tired and it's already different and difficult living in the monastery and no dinner. And so I was staying in the duplex as a guest, and at 11 p.m. I went, okay, never mind, I'm just going to go to sleep. But then I went to the duplex, and I was just laying there thinking, you can't give in that easily. Just, you feel a little bit tired. So right before midnight tea, I got out of bed and went down and for midnight tea. And at that time, midnight tea was in the house. It wasn't in the, normally we have it in the dining hall now, and later on, when we remodeled our house, eventually we had it in the dining hall as well. But early on, it was in the house, and there was carpet, so you just slide the trays around. And there was only 5 monks and 2 Anagarikas at that time or something. So it was a pretty small community, easy to have the midnight tea in the house. And then I got kind of my second wind and stayed up till dawn. I remember Ajahn Pasano was there. Ajahn Amaro was away traveling. He was in New York giving some teachings. So this was a 1-week visit that I had, and there was just this one lunar observance day that I had the opportunity to stay up. And I remember it was Lungpor and Debbie. Debbie was also staying up till dawn every time. She was really into those all-night sits and really solid sitting. And it was Lungpor and Debbie and myself. I don't think there was anybody else in the hall. But I remember around 4 a.m. So we had that morning chanting at 3 a.m. People disperse around 3:30, and then I tried to keep sitting. And at about 4, maybe 4:30 a.m., I fell over. So like I fell asleep sitting and my legs were still crossed, but I fell over with my legs still crossed. And then Debbie said she was looking over at me and wondering if she should wake me up or not. So, but eventually I kind of like got uncomfortable and got up because my legs were still crossed and it was quite painful actually. So that was my first all-night sit. And then later on, the all-night sits were incentivized. So this was when I must have been 2 vasas. It must have been somewhere around there. That Lungpor Pasano had learned Qigong in Thailand at Nanachat or something. So somebody visited. At England as well. And so there were a few of us who wanted to learn Qigong from him. So it was winter retreat. He said, okay, well, I'll teach it after the 3 a.m. chanting every week. Anybody who wants to learn Qigong can learn it after the 3 a.m. chanting. And so there was a handful of us, and Debbie was there. There was an Anagarika. I might have been a novice. I can't remember. But Anagarika Adam Kane was there. And Yeah, there was a handful of us in the house doing Qigong, maybe five of us. And it was kind of learn a new move each week. But it was really good because then we were very awake. We were very awake after doing the Qigong. And then it was easy to stay up till dawn. So it's kind of like you push yourself and do this, but then it was actually really beneficial and made it actually easier to stay up and got your energy going and you felt really balanced. And so, yeah, that's I still do that Qigong today, learning it all those years ago. It's been a very good practice, and something can be integrated into the practice, can be very helpful with the sitting meditation practice, and also just for waking up in the morning, can be very helpful to wake up in the morning and do some Qigong, do a routine. I know eventually Longpo Pasino had to stop doing Qigong because of his hip issues, but then he was missing the Qigong after a few years of not doing it, and then he forgot it, so then he asked me to teach him what he taught me in terms of the Qigong. I remember that was at Berkeley. That was at Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. Yeah, it's a... It's kind of one of the benefits if you teach somebody something. If you forget it, they can teach it back to you. So there's all these different epochs of Abhayagiri, all these different periods of time. And it's certainly not a perfect place, but it's good enough. It's good enough for the practice. And it's just like being human. A monastery is... just like it's like a creature that has all these, it's alive and it kind of moves around and kind of like being human. So we aren't, none of us match like an ideal of perfection. So we all have our foibles and mannerisms and whatever, you know, whatever we come into this world with and however we were brought up. So, but then we try to practice, we take on the ideals of the Buddha. And we try to practice with ourselves, and sometimes we can be overly hard on ourselves because our mind doesn't match the ideal. We're not settling into just like going into really deep states of meditation when we sit down, or maybe sometimes that happens. But really what the Buddha's pointing to is awareness. So mindfulness and awareness, the Thai Ajahns, they keep talking about sati sampajanya. And this is just super important. This is why a place like this exists. It's for cultivating sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear awareness. So over the years with all of our attempts to cultivate sati sampajanya, then we build facilities which do that. We build schedules and try to make a community that fosters that. We try to keep that as the central focus, as the main focus. Also, things like patient endurance and generosity and builds up a certain energy about it. But no monastery is perfect. Like you go to a place like Wat Pa Pong or you go to a place, you know, like you go to one of these really strict Dhammayut monasteries in Thailand, or some meditation monastery, strict retreat monastery where they don't do any work, they just meditate. And you might shop around, go to these different places. And I think what Ajahn Pasino and Ajahn Amaro came up with here at Abhayagiri is a very good balance of all these things. So you might go to, a place like Wat Doi Dhammachedi. Like, all they do is sweep all the time. They're not, you know, what are they doing? Or you might go to a place like one of these retreat monasteries in the north of Thailand, and they're not working at all, they're only meditating, and they give you food through a little, you sit in a room and they give you food, and you might think, oh, that's the real practice. But then after a period of time doing that, people might think, well, oh, there's nothing to do here except be with the mind. It's like, this is really awful. And then try to go to Wat Pa Pong, and all they do is work here. You know, what are they doing? They're not doing the real practice. So real practice comes back to these Dhamma qualities. It's not really, there is something to the externals, but the externals aren't as important as the internal qualities that we're trying to develop. So that's generosity, patient endurance. You see somebody like, thinking of honoring our elders, somebody like Lungpur Liam. So part of our standard here at Abhayagiri is that for bhikkhus, before your third vasa, you get to go away and spend your third vasa elsewhere at a branch monastery of your choice. It could be England, Thailand, Australia, New Zealand, or wherever we have a branch monastery. And we get to spend 1 year. And so I chose to go to Thailand. Many of the monks end up choosing to go to Thailand, wanting to get back to the roots and see where the tradition came from. And so I spent my third vasa at Wat Phananachat. And it was right now the abbot of Wat Phananachat is a German monk named Ajahn Kavali. But when I first went there, it was Ajahn Yanadamo was the abbot. And so I spent my third vasa there and I had met Lungpur Liam here at Abhayagiri previous to that in 2004. So I went in June 2005 to Thailand, and the year previous had been around Lungpur Liam, met Lungpur Liam, and was his attendant, was his upatak at that time when he was visiting. But I didn't yet know, I had never seen him on his home turf at Wat Nong Papong and been in Thailand and really been in that culture, so I was really keen to go. So went, spent the vasa at Wat Phananachat, and then definitely really benefited from being in Thailand, and that really helped me to see the Buddhist culture, especially all the senior monks in Thailand, and especially Lungpur Liam in Thailand, and looking at his example and just being around him, and that was, I just really learned a lot from that period of time. And they have these big projects where a lot of the Wat Phapong monks, they get together and they build, say a senior monk passes away or whatever, they'll build a chetty, the monks and lay people, they'll all work together, pouring concrete and doing whatever needs to be done to build a chetty. I remember my first Wat Phapong work project that I attended was going for a few days to help pour concrete for the building of the chetty at a monastery called Pudindang. It's one of the earliest, it might even be the first Wat Phapong branch monastery, the first or the third or something.
Not quite, but it was
one of the first.
Yeah, one of the very early.
One of the very early branch monasteries of Wat Phapong. And the monk they were building the chetty for was a Lungpur Mahasupon, who unfortunately I never got to meet, but heard a lot of good things, and a monk of great merit and barami. And that's also, incidentally, where I first met Ajahn Jayanto, was at that work project. He was living in Thailand at that time. He was actually taking a 9-year break from Amaravati. So, recovering for 9 years. Well, he was on kind of an extended Tudong period. He had traveled in India and was living in Thailand in different places. So just practicing, living and practicing and doing traveling. And met him at this, I guess he was staying at Wat Phapong at the time, so I met up with him. And remember, we had to like clear rocks out of this field and put rocks into this cart and move them elsewhere and dump them in another, move one pile of rocks and dump it in to make another pile of rocks. And remember Ajahn Jayanto and I were picking up rocks together and talking and chatting. He was asking where I was from. And then I just remember one of my perceptions of this day was the whole Nanachat Sangha, whoever wanted to go, we went there and can't remember, we might have just stayed for a day or we might have stayed for a few days at Pudindang helping build this chetty, but it was having the meal, which is about 9 a.m. There's no breakfast, so it's just you have the meal pretty early on, and then you have the whole day to work. And so then I remember being really amazed at what they were doing. There was just pouring concrete and moving rocks and passing buckets of concrete up. And Lumpur Liam was there, and he was just also helping out and doing some directing. Then I remember through the day, it's like, wow, this is really hard work and getting really tired. And then, well, it's almost nighttime, so we'll be able to take a rest and maybe have a cup of tea or something. And so it gets to be nighttime, and then they wheel out these lights, and they don't stop at nighttime. They just keep going till it's done. they don't care what time it is. So that was like, so I was sitting down, and then I guess some of the Thai monks, they could see I was pretty tired, so they were bringing me over. They have these kettles of cocoa and coffee that they run around with, these Thai monks were pouring me some cocoa, and then they're like, what is he like for allowables? Like, I don't know, what do Westerners like? And they were trying to figure it out, and they decided that they would give me this chopped up thing. It's called Samaw. But they thought, I might not be able to eat Samaw because it's very astringent. Like, it's kind of a strange thing, but it's allowable. And they thought, we have to make it better for him. So then they poured Blue Boy all over it. And Blue Boy is this like red, they call Nam Dang in Thai. And it's like this sickly sweet kind of syrup stuff. So that was like one of my earliest Thai Nampana experiences. They were all laughing. But just seeing the Wat Phapong monks and seeing how they work together, and it was really hard work, but it was not at all like working at a job. It was way different. It was really enjoyable. Everybody, and there was lay people there too who were working really late with the monks, and just really enjoyable. And almost like if you could describe like a feeling of boon or a feeling of merit, then people have so much faith. They're building a chetty for one of their teachers, so people have so much faith there, and really tapping into that. Was a really important experience for me. But also, a lot of what we have here, we try to bring that from Thailand, bring that energy from Thailand and transplant it here. So it's not just transplanting Buddhism, but Thai Buddhism in particular has so many wonderful things about it, and we don't necessarily want to just start from scratch. We do want to keep some of that form and like the camaraderie, the communal harmony. It's pretty unusual. They also, at Wat Phapong, having the first experience of this January, they call Ngan Patipat, where they come together to celebrate the anniversary of Lungpur Cha's death. And that's every January. They usually have a 1 week, like a 5 day to 7 day practice session at Wat Phapong. And there will be up to 10,000 lay people camping in the monastery. And you'll just see it like tents everywhere, little tents all through the forest. And they all come in, and there's food stalls set up, free food for anybody who comes into the monastery. And there'll be, as many as 1,000 plus monks there. And it's pretty amazing, people coming together in harmony, and then it culminates in a big circumambulation of Lungpur Cha's chetty where his bone relics are kept. So seeing that level of people coming together in harmony is pretty remarkable. It just so happens that at that time, we had this program for the lay people in the early days. It was called CALM, Community of Abhayagiri Lay Ministry. And this was actually, it was starting when I was in Anagarika. So I remember sitting in on some of these sessions and being happy to learn a bit from these sessions. It was like a multi-year sutta study / Vinaya monk's discipline study / ceremony and lifestyle study. number of lay people from around the country, and somehow they would, I think at least once or twice a year, they would all make it out here to Ubayagiri, but it was a handful, a group of lay people, maybe 16 or 18 lay people or something, 14 lay people who, Dennis was on that, and there's a few, I don't know if Rick, you were, no, you weren't on, you weren't connected yet at that time, and so when I was in Thailand for my third Vasa and after, because I spent a whole year there, they had their like graduation field trip, which was a trip to Thailand to visit all these ajahns and all these monasteries. And so they were at this, my first experience of one of these first, these big circumambulations at Wat Nong Papon. And they set up a food stall. So the Westerners, the only Westerners there in the food stall area, and they were the first Westerners, and I think nobody's done this since, actually, to have a food stall at Wat Nong Papong. And
the Italians have done it, I think, about a year or so.
Oh, the Italians, okay.
They're doing espresso and pizza.
Italians were doing espresso and pizza. So the Calm Group food stall, if I remember correctly, Plurin was also helping them, and but it was Tarania. It was Gloria's glorious muffins. Something she made.
They ended up doing funnel cakes.
Funnel cakes. Okay. Well, normally she does Gloria's glorious muffins. It changed to funnel cakes.
Well, it started. Had to get a bit simpler.
Had to get a little simpler than that. Yeah. So that was a big hit with people, and just a lot of fun. So practice doesn't have to be like grim. Like when sometimes when we think of practice, we think of like, you know, just killing the defilements and stamping the mind, you know, stopping these horrible mental proliferations in the mind, and just like all this greed, hatred, and delusion that's causing trouble for myself and others, and just obliterating it. And so we can come to the practice and have this sense that it's like, you know, death or glory, kind of very, very grim. And certainly I did relate to the practice in that way when I first came here. But then that really changed when I was in Thailand. It was, oh, okay. That was like a real wake-up call. Like, it can actually be fun. Wow. I had no idea. I remember trying to get some materials together for this whole 25th anniversary thing. And at first I was thinking of putting maybe some video clips together, but it was beyond my expertise level in the computers. But I was asking around for old video clips. And there's a monastery, a nunnery in Bangkok called Satian Damasatan. And I remember this well-known Mechi, white-robed nun, Mechi Sansini, a Thai nun. She had come here in 2002. I thought she'd came here in 2004. But actually, she came here in 2002 when I was a novice. And I remember they did a bunch of videotaping for some show they were doing when they were here. And they were here at Katina time. So it was after the Vasa. And so I contacted them and I said, do you have those old videos? Could you share those with me or anything? And they did find them. They dug up like an old video and then shared it with me, like a video file. And so I watched it, and it's got a very nice interview with Ajahn Pasano, and also it has Ajahn Amaro in Montgomery Woods walking with the Thai people, and it's all videotaped. It might be the only footage we have of Montgomery Woods, actually. And then it's got footage of the Katina. So I was a novice, and Obaso was a novice. He hadn't quite ordained as a bhikkhu yet. So it was for the Katina ceremony itself, it was a group of, I think there was actually only 5 bhikkhus for that Vasa, which is the bare minimum for having a Katina. So there was the 5 bhikkhus, and then there was the 2 novices. It was Obaso and myself. And then there was Anagarika Craig Randolph was there, now known as Ajahn Ahingsako, Abbot of Chithurst. So he was the Anagarika, just junior to me. And he was there in the video. And but it was fascinating to see this video just because I just don't have that many memories from that period of time. But I do know it was a period of time when when I had that idea of being like as tense as possible, you know, as strict as possible, as tense as possible, and tight, and it always needs to be tighter. And it's like you have like a bolt, a nut and a bolt, and you take the bolt, and it's already tight, but you have to get it tighter, so you're kind of wrenching on it. And so this video, it was at the mealtime on Katina Day, and there was a bunch of lay people in the Dhamma Hall over there, now the dining hall, and the camera was panning from Ajahn Pasano and just showing the whole community, and it got down to like Obaso and myself, and yeah, I was just sitting there just like totally, it was just too much. Just looked utterly miserable. And so that was pre-Thailand. I do remember before going to Thailand too, and taking leave of Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro, and we do this forgiveness asking and taking leave, and then one or both of them said, when you go to Thailand, you will realize how American you are. And I totally, that was exactly it. That was like, wow, yeah, I'm a Farang. That's just how I am. That's how it is when you're a Farang. So it's like trying to internalize. I think I was still young enough. I could maybe internalize some of that and, you know, learn about the Thai language. I was really intent on learning Thai. So I remember being at the Vasa, Wapananachat. Through the Vasa, there's different alms rounds. One of the things I loved about being in Thailand was the daily alms round. So that's just part of your day. You gather for alms round. You're at the sala, at the Dhamma hall. You prepare your bowls and everything, and you go out. Usually it's right at dawn. Go out for alms round. And some of the alms rounds, if you're a junior monk at Wapananachat, you get put on these really long alms rounds sometimes. So the longest one was Tungbon, which you'd be barefoot for the whole alms round. You'd be walking. You know, it's about probably about this, not quite as long as walking to Fry Vineyards from here. You're walking down this road, and then you go through the village on barefoot, but then you would walk back through these rice fields, and it was like dirt road, gravel road, as you're just kind of like barefoot and trying to make your way back. And that is paved now, so it's actually much easier now. Going alms around there, but I remember going on that long alms route, Tungbon village, and reciting the alphabet. I would recite the Thai alphabet every morning, and that's kind of how I started. I can attribute just the alms around as remembering a teaching of Ajahn Chah saying, if you want to learn something, go ahead and recite it every morning on alms around, and if you want to learn the Padimokkha, recite it when you're going on alms round in the morning time. So you just have that time every day. So I was reciting the all the consonants and vowels of the Thai language at that time, and still by the end of the year I couldn't speak Thai, but it kind of started getting internalized a bit. It's actually hard to learn Thai at Wapananachat. You really have to be like in a Thai monastery. But that year, remember the Calm group came on their trip in January, and we traveled around, and then I had been living it. So after the Vasa, I had gone to this little branch monastery, Pujum Gom, and founded by Ajahn Pasano in 1991 or something, and then joined up with got food poisoning super bad, and then 2 days after that joined up with the Calm group, coming on their field trip, and traveled around with them. We had a bus, and we were traveling around, and it was just, Debbie was there, Metika, yeah, everybody was there, everybody on the Calm group, they were all there, and going around to different monasteries. We went to Ajahn Anan, Wat Mopjon, we went to Ajahn Dan, Bunya Wat, and yeah, many other places. Wat Nong Papong, of course, that was really the culmination, that staying at Wat Nong Papong. Then I got to spend 4 months in Dao Dam on the Burmese border. Got sent out earlier than... This is a place that group from Wat Pananachak goes in the hot season deep into the jungle, the Burmese border. And then got to spend a month at Wat Bapong. And that month was very profound for me, because just seeing Lungpor Liam, being around him every day, seeing how he structures the monastery and how things work there. And yeah, that was a very interesting time, very good time, that particular month. And that year in Thailand really planted this faith. And then, of course, I had to come back to Ubayagiri. Is the rule is you're away for 1 year, you come back for your fourth and fifth Vasa. And after the fifth Vasa, that completes our what's called Nisaya, or basic training. So essentially our basic training is more or less 7 years here. Then if you're not a complete basket case, or you've internalized the training well enough, then you're released from Nisaya. You can actually do things like go live with different teachers, live at different monasteries for longer periods of time. So I chose to go straight back to Thailand after that for 4 more years. But so I haven't been here the whole time. There's been chunks. There's been epochs that I've missed. There's people who ordained as Anagarkhas here who I never met. For example, there's an Anagarkha, Kevin, who I never met. But I heard people talking about him when I got back from Thailand later on. And there was 2 Anagarkha Kevins, so I met the first one, but not the second one. There's been about 4 or 5 Anagarkha Scots, I think. I think we're on the 5th right now. So you do, yeah, you get so many people coming and trying out the training over the years. One kind of thing that hit me when I was at Wat Bapong was Lungpor Liam talking about the facilities in the monastery. He tends to talk about just very practical things and talking about the facilities, and there's a Pali word for the facilities, and that's the sasana watu. That's the objects connected with the sasana, with the religion, with Buddhism. So when we look after the Sainasana, which is the dwelling places, the kutis, the Dhamma hall, and everything else, we look after those things, and we look after them because they belong to the Buddha Sasana. And also just any objects, any facilities that we build them for the sake of being able to practice better. So we always keep that in mind. So I really, before going to Thailand, I didn't really have my mind around what was kind of the ethos around building things in the monastery. But really coming back from Thailand is kind of like, oh yeah, you hold that in your mind, that's what we're building things for. We're building dwelling places so people can come and have a secluded place in the forest to practice and abide here and cultivate Sila Samadhi Panya. We're building this meditation hall so that people can come here and cultivate Sila Samadhi Panya, cultivate the path. It's not necessarily about just doing the work in and of itself, even though that can be great, that can build a lot of camaraderie, and you have a sense of accomplishment when you get it done. But really it's about making facilities so that there can be a place where people can come and practice and have their needs looked after, so that they can focus on the practice. Things like Sila, like people who come and stay more than just a day visit, so people who are overnight guests in the monastery hold the 8 precepts. So because of these facilities, because of what we have, people are able to more easily come here and hold the precepts. And that's actually a gift to people and to the world, making the world a better place through just people coming and keeping the precepts and having facilities where they can more easily keep the precepts. Having secluded dwelling places, this is where people get that opportunity to go up and abide in the forest, be in the forest, be on their own, and try to understand what that's like. What is it like when we're on our own? You know, when we're just completely by ourselves and we don't have to act in a certain way based on being around other people. So how do we act when we're by ourselves and when we're holding sila? So when we hold the eight precepts and we're by ourselves and we're not seeking entertainment or looking for some sort of escape or distraction, what happens to the mind? So we go inward with the sitting meditation, the walking meditation, or we might engage in some sort of study of the suttas. The word sutta means thread, or it's like a Sanskrit sutra. So like suture, English is suture. So it's really coming from the same root. So these things are all the building of the facilities, the coming and dwelling and practicing, the virtue and the sense restraint. These are all threaded together. These are all connected. These are all like a sutta. They're all connected together. And we do actually need the sasanawatu. We need the facilities. So this comes back to that being human aspect of the practice. We might have an ideal, like, well, the Buddha said monks are supposed to live at the foots of trees. Why do we need this Dhamma hall? Why do we need kutis? But when we actually go and try to do that, it's very difficult. It's a rare person who can actually do that and live outside, live in the elements. Yes, that's the ideal. And yes, we should try that. And at the same time, we're human, so what we don't realize is that takes unbelievable skill to actually do that, to actually live out in the forest and live outside without a roof over our head long term. To live that way takes real training. That's why we don't even go to Tudong until after we're five vasas. The Dhamma and the Vinaya, the discipline has to be so internalized that we can live outside, we can live anywhere as monastics. But we need those facilities to really get there. So, of course, the Buddha recognized that, and he even made it against the rules to not have a kuti, not have a dwelling place during the vasa, during the rains. So even if we live outside, we have to be assigned to a dwelling place. Something we do during the Vasa period here at Abhayagiri, we study the Vinaya, we study the precepts. Usually we go straight through the 227 bhikkhu precepts, but then we also study what's called the watas, the kichawatas. In Thai they say kawat. So the kichawata, the protocols and etiquettes, and these come up a lot in the Thai forest tradition, the acharya wata, how you look after the teacher. The Akanduka Wata, which is looking after guests, the, you know, everything, the Senasana Wata, how to look after the dwelling place properly. We learn about all those Kichawatas as well, and that's also something that's just every year. It's been part of the rhythm, part of the pulse of Abhayagiri, of the monastery. So not only do we, so in terms of a year, we have the winter retreat. We begin our year with the winter retreat. 3 months of retreat period, we study the Dhamma. There's Dhamma readings, Dhamma teachings. Winter retreat crew comes and looks after the kitchen. There's a maintenance crew, and the monastic community focuses wholeheartedly on the practice and on the study of Dhamma. April comes through. We receive guests again. And during that time, there's usually a fair amount of coming and going, traveling, and the activity ramps up in the monastery. And if there's any building projects or anything to look after, that happens during that time. You enter the Vasa period. There's still work, still building projects, because the Vasa period here isn't the rains retreat. It isn't the rains per se. It isn't the monsoon season like it is in Asia. But still, we observe it. There's a lot of rules around it. You have a formal entering of the Vasa. You have the ending of the Vasa, you have the Katina ceremony. So there's all these Vinaya rules around it. So we still observe it. And during that time, we have Vinaya classes. So we study the Vinaya during that time. And the monastic community would sit around and we'd do real life situations, discuss real life scenarios around our rules and the discipline and the Vinaya. How do we, like the money rules, we can't accept money, but there's a lot of different things around money these days. So what happens when somebody offers you a Starbucks gift card, for example? Can you accept it? Can you not accept it? Yes, you can, because it's a prepaid gift card. So it's not actually money. So, but then things like credit cards, well, no, because it actually is too close to being actual money. And so we talk about the rules in that way. And real life scenarios, modern life scenarios, how do we hold these rules and still keep to the spirit of them? And also you can't, like a bhikkhu can't leave for longer than 6 nights, and he has to have a valid reason to leave during that time. So the community is very stable during that time, during the Vasa period. Then there's the Katina ceremony, which is a big coming together of the lay people and a big offering ceremony. So that Vasa period with the Vinaya classes, then the Katina ceremony, there will tend to be more traveling then and coming and going and visiting elders. Like Longpor Viradamo would make a point of coming here nearly every year, sometimes coming for the Katina ceremony. There's a plan for Ajahn Amaro to come this year for the Katina ceremony, so we'll see if we can make that happen. And then there's the slowdown period, and Longpor Pasano would actually go to Thailand every year in December, and he'd be gone for a month, so that was a yearly thing, keep that connection going with Thailand, with all of the various energies at Wat Bapong, Wat Phananachat, and Bangkok. Yeah, just keep that connection going. So that's really like there is a certain pulse to the year in the monastery, and it seems very balanced. You get the winter retreat. You've got that good chunk of time for diving into the practice head first, and got other times which are doing a bit more service for the community and allowing people into the monastery as guests. And so we've got these different periods of time we can use. And so with all the memories that have built up over the past many years over Abhayagiri, there is this kind of like pulse that's become established in the monastery. And yeah, it's quite good. And it just builds up over the years. There's just so many people who have come through here at this point, and so many people who have come and gone. Some have come and stayed, some have come and stayed for a while and then left. And it's very much a center of learning as well. So we try to provide a center for people to learn about the practice. Also, another part of that pulse I forgot to mention was the Thanksgiving retreats. Those were actually happening since before the inception of Abhayagiri. And these Thanksgiving retreats, and I think it was done at Thanksgiving just because that was the only open slot at the time. They were doing it at Spirit Rock for a while, I think. Or it used to be like Spirit Rock, Angela Center, Trade-Off.
Just a few times at Spirit Rock.
Okay.
Mostly
at the Angela Center, but sometimes at Spirit Rock, yeah. And so Kathy is here now. Managed the last three Thanksgiving, the last three Thanksgiving retreats. And Hitesi was the manager before that, right? So that's part of it as well, doing these Thanksgiving retreats, which last year, because of the pandemic, having it in-house and doing it online, kind of similar to how we're doing this. So, and then things change. So we get it. Like Ajahn Amaro was talking about yesterday, he's talking about his leaving Abhayagiri in 2010. And So things change. You think things are going to be a certain way, and then they shift and change. You think the world's a certain way. It shifts and changes, and we move on. So there is that. That happens as well. That is happening at Abhayagiri as well. So we continue to feel it out, but wanting to keep that intention of having facilities that are here for practice. That's really what Abhayagiri is. And also Abhayagiri is the people. That's something Ajahn Amaro always used to teach us. Abhayagiri, if you want to say what is Abhayagiri, Abhayagiri is the people who are there at any given time. Abhayagiri is the community. So we are Abhayagiri, all of us. And it's good to think about this, good to reflect on these things. This is also part of just seeing how we can learn over the years, and how, I mean, just thinking for myself, like taking that step from, and it can take courage actually to loosen up and actually be at ease, to actually dare to be at ease, dare to be happy, dare to tighten that bolt, don't tighten it, dare to loosen the bolt a little bit, put some oil on it and loosen it, and dare to be at ease. So I'll leave that as a Dhamma talk for today.